Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin.
And you're here in the University of Bristol with us. And Liz, what have you been up to?
I have just been working on some 3D models of pterosaurs using CT scans. So I've been working on that all day and just lost half my data, which was fun.
Ah.
Yeah, oh well. How about you?
I've not been in all morning. I've got a lot of work to be doing. But yes, I keep on procrastinating, unfortunately. There's so many things on the internet that are just grabbing my attention instead. So many trailers out.
Yes.
You're excited?
Yeah, there's been lots of good trailers out in the last, I guess, week or so.
Yep. So, the elephant in the room, Jurassic Park.
Yeah, just mostly sad because there were no giant pterosaurs, but, you know, I guess we'll see.
Well, they did that in Jurassic Park 3, didn't they?
Yeah.
Can't be all about pterosaurs.
No, but you can always have more. Come on.
So I guess it's back to giant predatory dinosaurs?
Yeah, I guess, you know, Jurassic Park is pretty much nothing without the big theropods, so back into theropod dinosaurs.
Yeah, we'll see what they concoct with this genetically modified one.
Yeah, that will be interesting. We'll see what they've managed to stick together in some giant killing machine.
Yeah, but back in the real world, theropods.
Yeah, so we were fortunate enough to talk to Steve Brusati from the University of Edinburgh when we were at SVP in Berlin, and we had a chat with him about theropods and kind of the evolution of theropods, so we'll learn about some actual theropod paleontology.
It's a shame we didn't ask him about designing some new ones.
Yeah.
What kind of features you'd add in?
Yeah, maybe that will be the next interview instead.
Or maybe we could just all wait for the film to come out.
Yeah, I guess just under a year for that, so wait and see what happens.
Well, hopefully you can all put up with some standard theropods for half an hour, so hope you enjoy this episode.
Joining us.
Yep, thanks Liz, thanks for having me.
So you're now a fellow in the School of Geosciences at the University of Edinburgh, is that right?
That's right, yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to that position?
Yes, so I'm on the faculty in Edinburgh now. I think everybody listening can tell from hearing me that I'm not Scottish. I hope so, at least. I'm working on the Scottish accent, but I'm from the U.S. I grew up around Chicago. And did an undergrad degree in Chicago. I was a student of Paul Sorino's, and that's how I got started studying dinosaurs. And then from there, I got a scholarship called a Marshall Scholarship that brings some American students over to the UK, and I went to Bristol and did a master's in Bristol and worked with Mike Benton on archosaurs, on early archosaur phylogeny and evolution. And so that was kind of my introduction to Britain. And I met my future wife in Bristol. That would come back and become an important part of my career trajectory. But we moved back then to the U.S. together, and I went to New York, to Columbia and AM&H, and did my PhD there with Mark Norell. So Sorino, Benton, Norell, I had quite an array of really well-known and prominent advisors, and I've learned a lot from all of them. And so I finished in New York. I did a dissertation on Silurosaur dinosaur phylogeny and the evolutionary transition between dinosaurs and birds, and finished that about 2 years ago, November 2012. And while I was a PhD student, you know, I started applying for jobs, and this position in Edinburgh came up, and Edinburgh was hiring a lot of young people across the university. And they've made hundreds of hires, actually, and a bunch of people in geosciences, and I was one of them. So I've been there about 2 years, and building up a research lab there now, and I have my first crop of PhD students and first postdocs, first bit of research funding, so things are going all right, and we're building up a Scottish vertebrate paleontology research group.
Sounds good. Sounds like it'll be a lot of fun, at least. So you kind of alluded to this in the beginning, but you've worked on a lot of different groups. I guess you've worked on some early archosaurs and dinosaurs. What other fossil groups have you started looking at and worked on?
Yeah, I've definitely, over the last 10 years or so, as I've, you know, started doing research as an undergrad, I did start, you know, fairly young. And since that time, it's just always been expanding out and doing new things, working on new groups and new methods and new techniques. And a lot of it is, you know, when you start doing field work, you end up finding stuff and, you know, you start wanting to know what you found and you become an expert, try to become an expert in different things. So I started with dinosaurs, with theropod dinosaurs, and that's still, I would say, my bread and butter as a researcher, you know, my specialty. And that includes the origin of birds, and that includes tyrannosaurs, and, you know, mostly anatomy and phylogenetics and macroevolution of theropods. But, yeah, over time, you know, I've worked, my master's was on early archosaur evolution, kind of the rise of dinosaurs, how dinosaurs got their start, how that was influenced by mass extinctions. And then that, you know, led me into working a little bit more on some quantitative methods, things like that. Worked a lot with disparity techniques and evolutionary rates, phylogenetic methods. And then more recently, you know, I've been working on mammals a bit more with Tom Williamson, who's a really good friend and colleague of mine. We've been doing field work together for about 5 or 6 years. Tom's been doing field work in the American West for decades. So I've been part of this group that Tom has put together looking at the KPG extinction in North America. What happened to dinosaurs, of course, at that extinction? That's something we've been working on recently. But more than kind of what happened with the dinosaurs, it's what happened to the things that survived? Why did some things survive and other things go extinct? And for those things that survived, like certain types of mammals, what happened to them afterwards in this world where there were no dinosaurs left? So that's been a big part of my focus for the last few years, and it's becoming more of my focus, a little bit more of a transition to mammals away from dinosaurs. So I'm learning a lot about teeth, and, which is good fun. But there's some incredible, funky, weird mammals that lived and flourished and thrived during the 10 million years or so after the dinosaurs went extinct, but before the major modern groups of mammals like rodents and bats and whales and elephants and primates rose up. That was about 55 million years ago or so. So there was this 10 million year period right after the extinction with all of these so-called archaic mammals that are extinct now. We don't really know what they're closely related to. So that's a big focus of what we're trying to do, is figure out what these mammals are and what they tell us about the recovery from that extinction.
Are there a lot of good sites in the US and in North America that show that KPG kind of transition?
Yeah, in North America, we're very fortunate because we're fortunate in a sense. The rest of the world is kind of unfortunate in a sense, because North America is right now the only place that really has good records of fossil vertebrates for, you know, many millions of years up to a well-dated, well-constrained Cretaceous Paleogene boundary, and then a good record of fossil vertebrates, terrestrial vertebrates after that boundary. So you have sequences like the Hell Creek Formation, the Fort Union Formation in Montana and the Dakotas, where you have this entire sequence, and you can see dinosaurs changing, and then dinosaurs go out, and you can see what mammals are doing, and then you can see the extinction, and you see a lot of mammals go out, and you see what mammals then do afterwards. You can't really do that in other parts of the world. There's a few places in Europe that are promising. In northern Spain, in the Pyrenees, there's some great sites that are starting to be worked on, and there is KPG boundary there, and there is a good record of vertebrates before and after, but the research is relatively new. Places like, you know, there's some potential maybe in places like Romania and some other parts of Europe. In some parts of Asia, there's some sections in China that maybe have a KPG boundary, and you can look at vertebrate evolution, but really it's a North American game right now. And that is one of the problems with trying to understand, for instance, the dinosaur extinction, because we have this great record in North America. It's pretty clear. Dinosaurs are doing pretty well. There's some little changes in dinosaur faunas, but then bam, they go extinct really suddenly when the asteroid hits. But that is the North American pattern. Maybe that isn't exactly what happened in other parts of the world, and we just don't know right now. So it's one of these fossil record biases that we just always have to keep in mind.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize there were so many good transitional sites that go through that whole transition. So that's nice that you can kind of go through it that way.
Yeah, the Hell Creek is the best, but in New Mexico, where Tom and his crew have been working for a long time, there also is a really good section. We don't have a perfectly dated KPG boundary. We kind of know where it is within a small stratigraphic section, but there's no iridium layer, at least that we know of yet. But good records of dinosaurs, and then great records, some of the best records in the world, of those mammals that were starting to flourish within tens of thousands of years after the dinosaur extinction. So it was really quick.
So going back to theropod dinosaurs a little bit,
What got you into working with them? Why did you decide to start working on theropods?
I mean, a lot of people... rightly so. People are interested in theropods. And you go to meetings like SVP, and you always meet a lot of young students. I always have a lot of young students come up to me and ask me questions about theropods. And, tell me, I want to work on theropods. And, there's something... I mean, look at T-Rex. T-Rex is... the dinosaur icon, of course. Biggest predator to ever live on land. Well, give or take, maybe a few others were about the same size. But there's something cool about theropods. But that's not really why I got into them. I mean, I didn't really care about dinosaurs as a kid. I mean, I meet a lot of students that have, from the time they were like 3 years old, they wanted to study T-Rex, which, all right, a little strange maybe. But I wasn't like that. And I actually became interested in theropods working with Paul Serino because the first summer that I did a research project with Paul. Paul, of course, has been collecting in Africa and many places in the world for decades now, and Paul has just amassed a huge collection of dinosaurs and other things. And he had some new theropod material of a theropod called Carcharodontosaurus, which is a big kind of T-Rex-sized predator that lived in Africa in the middle part of the Cretaceous. And Paul had described other Carcharodontosaurus material earlier, a really nice skull from Morocco. And then he had some new stuff from Niger, a few bones, different parts of the skull, and that's what he thought would be a good summer project for me. And so that's basically how I got started. So it was kind of a quirk, really, that I was given theropod material. Paul could have given me turtle material, God forbid, or even worse, ornithischian material. But he happened to give me material of one of the biggest theropods to ever live. And so that's how it got started. So Paul was very instrumental in that. And then, the next summer I did another project on some other theropods that Paul had from different parts of Africa. And so, it really was because of Paul Serino that I got into theropods. And we published some papers together on that stuff. And that's how I really got into being a publishing scientist. And, at first SVPs I presented on those theropods. And it was really that work with Paul that got me into being a researcher.
Mm. People often think of theropods as just big teeth, massive carnivores, but that's not really the case. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of the diversity of theropods and all the differences between them?
Well, birds don't have teeth, hummingbirds aren't very big, and that, right there kind of illustrates that, of course, birds are living theropods, and just right there, there's 10,000 living birds, incredible diversity, and you look at living birds and compare them to things like T-Rex and Coelophysis and Allosaurus, very, very different. So, obviously, tons of diversity in theropods, and even if for a minute we kind of forget about birds and just think about those theropods that lived during the Mesozoic, even then, a huge amount of diversity. Theropods evolved, right at the beginning of the time of dinosaurs. You have theropods in the very earliest fossil sites in Argentina where you have the first dinosaurs, 230 million years ago or so. And then you have, theropods continuously up until dinosaurs go extinct. And you have all different kinds of theropods. You have huge ones like T-Rex that were top predators. And you have lots of different groups of theropods that independently evolved T-Rex type size and were top predators at different times and on different land masses. And then you had a lot of smaller theropods, fast-running theropods. You had, of course, very bird-like theropods later on in time, covered in feathers, even had wings. And you also had a lot of theropods that didn't even eat meat. So you had lots of groups of theropods that evolved away from their meat-eating ancestors, things like therizinosaurs, these big pot-bellied plant-eating dinosaurs, Ornithomimosaurs, the ostrich-mimic dinosaurs, which, of course, the new Deinocheirus that was just announced is one of them, a weird Ornithomimosaur. But most of them had no teeth. They were probably omnivores of some kind. You had Alvarezsaurs, these little things with tiny little arms, some of them just one finger, probably using their little finger to poke bugs out of nests, So a huge amount of diversity within this group that most people, I think of theropods, they think of T-Rex, I think of big predators, but the big predators are only one of many different types of theropods.
Going back to the kind of theropod bird discussion, I know you recently had a paper come out looking at that transition. Can you tell us a little bit about your paper and how it's different from some of the other studies that have been done on the same transition?
Yeah, there's been a lot of work on this area recently. My paper stems from my PhD thesis, so it's something that we've been working on for a while, back to 2008, and it took us, you know, a little bit of time to get it out, a little bit longer than we wanted, but, you know, having to move transatlantically during that period kind of put some projects on hold. So a lot of other papers did come out in the interim on the same topic, but we've all approached it slightly differently. So our paper, it started as part of my PhD thesis, you know, so collaboration with Mark Norell, my advisor, and then it grew to include two other really good colleagues of mine, Graham Lloyd, who's in Australia now, and Steve Wong, who's a statistician in Pennsylvania. And so the paper, it does a few things. First of all, I mean, we have a big new phylogeny of birds and their closest relatives among theropods. And this is the latest of this theropod working group project that Mark Norell has led for the last couple of decades, where, you know, many students, many postdocs involved, always building bigger phylogenies as more taxa are described, as more fossils are found. So, you know, bigger and bigger data sets. So we have basically the most complete data set now. Of course, it'll get bigger over time, but something like 150 some celurosaurs, so derived theropods, 850 some characters. So big new phylogeny, that's the first part of it. But then we've used that phylogeny to look at evolutionary trends across the dinosaur-bird transition. So basically to look at that question of how did some dinosaurs turn into birds? Mm. You know, where did birds come from? And we looked at rates of evolution, and we also looked at morphospace occupation, kind of overall skeletal form, the overall diversity of all of these animals. And what we found is that really there was no moment in time when a dinosaur became a bird. You know, there's no one link between a dinosaur and a bird. Of course, I think most of us know that, but I think with the public especially, you always hear about missing links and, you know, the evolution kind of being something that happens one day, something like a land-living mammal turns into a whale or something like that. That's not how evolution works. And with birds and theropods, we have so many fossils now. We have such a great fossil record, and we have these big phylogenies, and we can look kind of over time at all of these fossils and see how this one lineage of theropods gradually over tens of millions of years is becoming more and more bird-like. So, you know, first feathers evolve, very primitive feathers, and then wishbones, and then bird-like lungs, and then more complex feathers, and then arms that can fold against the body, and then body size is reduced. And so it's kind of piece by piece, bit by bit, a bird is assembled gradually over evolutionary time. And that's pretty cool. But what we also found is even though birds evolved gradually, piecemeal, over tens of millions of years of dinosaur evolution, that when a complete bird body plan finally came together, and you had something where you had a small dinosaur with complex feathers, with wings, with a bird-like lung, when you had all of these features, then something seems to have been unlocked in an evolutionary sense, and that's when you start seeing really rapid rates of evolution. So kind of slow evolution over a long period of time, the bird body plan is gradually built up, but when that body plan comes together, then bam, something changed, and you see birds evolving, these earliest birds evolving at a supercharged rate. And I think that's a pretty interesting finding, and maybe this is something that might be more general about how major new groups, major new body plans evolve. So I think going forward, it'd be interesting to see if we see that with, say, the evolution of whales or the origin of tetrapods or other major transitions where you have these totally new groups, new body plans, new behaviors, new environments come into play.
So you wouldn't generally say that there's a cutoff between birds and dinosaurs. It's just sort of a continuum throughout. How do you make the distinction between what is a non-avian theropod and what is an avian theropod?
Yep, you got it, totally. And that's the thing. When you only have a few fossils of something, you know, it's easy to kind of draw a line on a phylogeny and say, well, these things are, you know, dinosaurs and these are birds. But all of these feathered dinosaurs from China over the past few decades, and also finds from other parts of the world, have really blurred those lines. And it's almost impossible. I would say it is impossible to draw a line on the phylogeny now and say that these are dinosaurs below this line and these are birds above this line. What we call birds really is just a convention. This A.V. Allen node, Archaeopteryx and living birds and all descendants of their most recent common ancestor. That's really just a historical convention because Archaeopteryx was found so long ago, it's always been considered a bird. And it, you know, it does look like a bird. It does have wings and modern flight feathers and these kind of features. But that really is arbitrary. And I think if you were standing around in the Cretaceous and you were you know, a Cretaceous bird watcher, Cretaceous dinosaur watcher, let's say, and you had your pair of binoculars and you were, you know, looking at some ecosystem and you saw a velociraptor type animal and you saw, say, a Confucius ornis type animal, Confucius ornis being an early bird, I don't think you would make any distinction between them at all. I think you'd consider them the same type of thing. Mm-hmm. The same way that if you see, you know, an ostrich and a buzzard together, you know, in the zoo or a savanna or whatever, I mean, you consider them the same type of animal. You don't make a big distinction. You might make a distinction between an ostrich and, you know, a lion, a bird and a mammal, but between, you know, two various birds, we realize, you know, they're the same general type of thing. And I think back then in the Cretaceous, in the Jurassic, you would consider dinosaurs and what birds were around then to be the same general type of animal. No real distinction between them.
Should we still be calling birds birds and theropods theropods then, or how do you...
Names are names. I mean, yeah. You don't want to lose the name theropod because theropods have a great brand name. I know, you know, it's like Coca-Cola is not going to change their name to, you know, something else. Yeah. It's established. So we don't want to change the theropod brand name. But no, I think, you know, birds, the thing about birds, birds is kind of an informal name. I mean, Theropoda is a formally defined name. There's a definition that we agree on. Birds is a little more vague. I mean, we have Aviali, that note, the Archaeopteryx note. And then we have Aves, the crown group of, you know, all living birds and the descendants of their most recent common ancestors. So really, those terms are more precise. And the bird being kind of a vague, not a formal taxonomic term, that helps, you know, make this bird term vague. And that helps... I'm using helps, it really kind of hinders our ability to use that to define something very clear. So whatever a bird is, some people might now say, oh, you know, a T-Rex is just a bird, and I would add feathers and all these other bird features, but it's not an avian, and it's not an avian.
Okay. Of course, we're in Berlin right now, and we had the nice opportunity to see the Archaeopteryx the other day. Which was, as you said, a big deal in terms of understanding bird evolution. What do you think the most important find is in that? Do you think Archaeopteryx really is that, or are there other things that have really influenced our understanding of bird evolution and theropod evolution?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of important fossils, but there's no doubt that Archaeopteryx is the fossil because, you know, it was found well over 140, 150 years ago. So it was found, you know, not long after Darwin wrote The Origin of Species. And it wasn't just a fossil that helped understand where birds came from. It was a fossil that was found right at this time when people were grappling with this idea of evolution. And so it was something that helped basically prove the reality of evolution to the public and also to other scientists and naturalists at the time. And so that just can't be overstated, the importance of finding such a clearly transitional fossil, this basically half bird, half reptile, which at that time, because not as much was known, it really was a link. I mean, nowadays, it's just part of this continuum because we have so many fossils. If you found Archaeopteryx now, you would say, well, that's just another cool feathered dinosaur. But back in the late 1850s, early 1860s, this was incredible to find a half bird, half reptile right around the time people are debating this, you know, really controversial new idea that this guy with a big beard from Sussex proposed. So Archaeopteryx is the key one, and being in Berlin is very cool to see that specimen in the Humboldt Museum, and it has its own little shrine. It's almost religious in a way. They've set up this shrine, but Archaeopteryx deserves as much, you know, kind of fame as it gets. It is probably the most important fossil that was ever found, single fossil. Maybe some of the paleoanthropologists would debate that. But nowadays, there's a lot of new fossils, a lot of new feathered dinosaurs. The feathered dinosaurs over the past two decades have been really important because they have completely settled the idea that birds evolved from dinosaurs. I mean, the bird-dinosaur idea goes way back to contemporaries of Darwin, people like Huxley. So it's not a new idea, and it's something that people, you know, had good evidence for long before feathered dinosaurs, but there were always people holding out. But it's not a controversy anymore. It's not. Everyone except for a handful of a few very marginal people accept the obvious reality that birds evolved from dinosaurs. And these feathered dinosaurs have proven that. You can use whatever cliche you want, final nail in the coffin or whatever, but those feathered dinosaurs, they have shown to the scientific community, but also to the public. When you can see something like Microraptor, a bona fide dinosaur covered in feathers, quill pen type of feathers, forming wings, it's obvious. You cannot argue with that. So those have been very important finds.
Moving away from birds a little bit, there's also been a lot of other theropod news recently. This last year, I think, has had a lot of big stories and a couple of new species named and old ones that were named that have found new material. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those kind of big finds and anything you've been involved in?
Yeah, it's an incredible time for dinosaurs. It really is. And the pace of discovery now is just at a rate that it's hard to believe. It's about 50 new species a year. So that means a new species a week is being found. So, I mean, not a new fossil, not a new skeleton, but a totally new type of dinosaur we never knew existed before. Once a week, somebody somewhere is finding one. And that's everywhere around the world. I mean, dinosaurs are known from every continent, and people are starting to find them in places where they had never been found before. And, you know, there have been many recent examples of that. These feathered ornithischians from Siberia. This is a place where you don't, you know, you think of Siberia, you don't think of dinosaurs, but some great new sites there. And, of course, places like China and Argentina and still the American West and still parts of Europe. So it has been, it's been a great year for dinosaurs. There have been a lot of these big discoveries, you know, the chicken from hell from North America, the Pinocchio Rex that that my colleague Jin-Chang Liu and I named in May. So you can see there's kind of a pattern here. You know, we've started to come up with these cheeky nicknames in a, you know, attempt to get our 15 minutes of fame in the Daily Mail.
Really. And how
that works
for you.
Well, you know, but some of these nicknames actually do, they do work in a sense that they do help reach the public, and you've seen that with a lot of these finds. A lot of them do have nicknames. So, you know, Dreadnoughtus, the big sauropod, that's not really a nickname, that's the scientific name. It's an awesome name, but that's a name people can relate to. And, you know, and so that's, you know, another example of a new discovery. Of course, Deinocheirus, the new fossils that came out a few weeks ago. Spinosaurus, the new material Spinosaurus, and there is, you know, a great new feathered dinosaur this summer. In addition to the Siberian plant-eating dinosaur feathers, there was another new feathered dinosaur from China, very close relatives of birds, but a big one, and a four-winged one, but also had a big tail with a lot of feathers. And so it's really every week there's something new, and there's some new surprise. And then you go to a meeting like this, and you see all kinds of new stuff, and so the next year, there's going to be plenty more papers coming out. So it's a great time to study dinosaurs, and there's still a lot to work on, which is a good thing. We're not exhausting our supply of dinosaurs. It's not like oil, you know, it's not going to be gone soon.
I had no idea so many species were named so frequently. I knew there were a lot of new ones still being named, but I had no idea it was 50 a year kind of thing. It's,
yeah,
quite remarkable.
And there's a lot of people studying dinosaurs, a lot of young people, of course, you know, us sitting around this table here are, well, not, we don't all work on dinosaurs necessarily, but a lot of young people as students going out, trying to find things. But also, it's not only scientists that find dinosaurs. In fact, it's oftentimes not scientists. So with the Pinocchio Rex discovery in China, this was made by workmen in 2010. So you have all this construction going on in southern China, throughout China, really. And these workmen working a backhoe hit something hard in the rock, and they cleared it away, and they found, oh, okay, well, we found a complete skeleton of a Tyrannosaur. Cool. Huh? Just another day in the job. So luckily, that found its way to the local museum, and a totally new species of this weird long-snouted Tyrannosaur that lived right at the end of the age of dinosaurs. And it's true also, a lot of the feathered dinosaurs, those are mostly found by farmers. So, you know, people all over the world, you know about dinosaurs now. Dinosaurs are in the press so much that people are out there trying to find them, and not only scientists.
Speaking of going out and looking for things, have you had much of a chance to go and do field work? Are you actively doing field work now that you're in Edinburgh?
Yeah. I mean, field work, it's not a huge part of my research program, at least compared to some people. Presuming, you know, that Phil Curry's interview goes up before mine. I mean, Phil is, you know, half of the year he's out all over the world. I mean, just finding incredible fossils, and he's done this throughout his career, and we're just in awe of people like Phil. And I'm not like that. Maybe about a month a year I'm out in different places. So, you know, I work a lot now in New Mexico with Tom Williamson and Dan Pepe and Ross Secord and this crew looking at the rise of mammals after the dinosaur extinction. That's a lot of fun. We have students. My first PhD student, Sarah, is working as part of that project. I've done a lot of field work in Europe kind of over the last 5 years. Not huge expeditions or anything like that, but done some fun work in Portugal in the Triassic with Octavio Mateus, who's, you know, very well known in Portugal, Richard Butler, Seb Steyer as well, and looking at what Europe was like during the time dinosaurs were rising up, during the time Pangaea was starting to split, during the time that this mass extinction was, you know, on the horizon, but you still had these Triassic faunas dominated by big temnospondyl amphibians where dinosaurs were just bit players. We've also worked in Poland looking at some of those things, again with Richard and also, you know, of course, with our great Polish colleagues, Gregor Znitzwicki, Tomasz Sule, who, great to see them at the meeting here. We're looking, you know, earlier in the Triassic, right after the end Permian extinction, right when archosaurs are starting to rise up. Tons of footprints in Poland help show this. Worked a lot in Romania with a great team of Romanians, of course. Liz knows, Matias Bremer, I mean, just a nose for fossils. I've never met anybody who is so good at finding fossils. Yeah. And, you know, that maybe even goes for people like Philip, too. I think Matias has a lot of these guys beat. And, you know, Zoltan Cichi, Radu Totianu in Romania, and then, of course, Garrett Dyke and Mark Norell, part of this great team. And as you can see here, you know, this field work, it's all very, very collaborative. And that's what it is these days. This isn't the days of, you know, Cope sending some assistant out in the field to find stuff, or, you know, Henry Fairfield Osborne sending Barnum Brown out to Montana, bring me back, you know, a big dinosaur. Everything's very international, big collaborative teams. You know, it's imperative to be able to work well together, and that's how so much fun work is going on now. So I've been very privileged to have a lot of good colleagues. And, you know, there's other places that I've worked too, and hopefully other places on the horizon. We want to do more work in Scotland. We've started to do a bit of work on Skye, incredible middle Jurassic fossils up there, very poorly sampled time interval anywhere around the world, and Scotland's one of the best places, believe it or not. So that's next on the horizon.
I can imagine that field work in Scotland is maybe slightly different from field work in New Mexico.
Yes, in every way possible. A couple years ago, I was in Sky up with Tom Challens and Mark Wilkinson and Dookie Ross, who work with in Sky. We were up in Sky for a week, and we found some cool stuff. Actually, we have some stuff that'll be coming out soon. You know, not huge complete skeletons, but some pretty neat Sky fossils. So stay tuned. But we were up there for about a week. It was in May, which in a lot of parts of the world, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, May's a nice time. The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing. No, in Scotland, it was, of course, pissing down rain, horizontal rain. It was cold. It was, you know, it was about 5 degrees. And then we went back to Edinburgh, and then a few days later, I left to go to New Mexico. We went out to New Mexico, and we're camping out in the desert with Tom and his crew, and it's 30 degrees, and it's blasting sun, and there's no rain. And you know, the only continuity between the two is that I brought a nice bottle of whiskey from Scotland to New Mexico, just to, you know, but it is, you know, when you work in different parts of the world, it's a fun thing because every part of the world is different, and you really get to meet a lot of interesting people. You get to see some great scenery, and you know, you just get to experience different people, different places. And I always tell, you know, young students, if you get a chance to travel, to do field work or visit a lot of museum collections, take the opportunity. That's a great part of the job that we have.
I definitely love going out doing field work, but I can't imagine doing it in New Mexico when it would be that hot.
Yeah, this was, well, Sarah, you know, my first PhD student, she came out with us last year, and you know, she's proper English lass, and you know, the heat, it's something that you have to get used to, and you know, it's just true of my wife as well. It's just something, you know, not to slag off on the English, but there's this optimum temperature range. I found this living in Britain, this optimum temperature range of, you know, like 1 degree, otherwise too hot or too cold. Dave is pointing here, and so, you know, this, but it is a thing that you know, that is one of the challenges of doing field work, that the weather and you know, working out in the desert can be pretty tough. So people that go out, you know, like Mark Norell's team that has worked in the Gobi for a long time, and Phil working in the Gobi, and, you know, Paul's, Serino's team's in the Sahara, when they're out there for months and months, that's something I've never done. And so I have all the respect for these teams that have done this.
I guess you have to be careful about what time of year you go and
yeah, like and you know that's also true of things like in Scotland, especially. You know, we can't go certain times because all the midges. You know, this is makes fieldwork hell. So you got to think about these things.
Well, that's great. I think that's pretty much everything I had to ask. Unless Dave has anything he wants to ask you as he's being frantically taking notes.
I've got a few questions.
Yeah.
Might as well. Whilst we still got you. So, one theropod a week. Do you think they're oversplit?
Yeah, well, one dinosaur a week, not quite one theropod. But are dinosaurs oversplit? That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, they probably are to some degree. But I still think we're in part of that collector curve, if you think about it, that we're still, you know, as a community, exploring lots of new areas. And it's not just that, you know, everybody is out in the Hell Creek and finding a new, you know, horn core of a ceratopsid and everybody's naming, you know, their fossil a new species. It's still people going out to this new part of Siberia or this unsampled part of Argentina and finding things that are definitely new. And you look at, you know, things like the Pinocchio Rex or Dreadnoughtus. I mean, these are very strange new dinosaurs. But yes, there probably is some oversplitting and, you know, that's taxonomy for you.
And then your weird mammals.
Yeah.
Straight after the KPG. Can you tell us a little bit about those? Can you explain them to us, like what they look like?
Yeah. I would say they're some of the biggest mysteries in all of paleontology. But they're not new. You know, it's not like 10 years ago some people went out to the American West and started digging right above the iridium layer and found some weird mammals. These things go all the way back to the time of Cope. And the problem has been that they're very bizarre. They're obviously mammals, and most of them pretty clearly are placental mammals or on the stem towards placentals, but they're not clearly members of the living groups. You know, so you're not finding rodents, you're not finding primates, you're not finding bats or elephants or those types of mammals. And so they occupy kind of this twilight zone of mammals where it's not obvious what they are, but there were a lot of them, and there were lots of different groups. And they flourished in North America, and they also flourished in other parts of the world, really during the Paleocene and parts of the Eocene. And then you have the PETM, the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum between the Paleocene and Eocene, and you have this sudden shift where you, not necessarily, you have some extinctions, but you have tons of originations after that, and that's where the more modern groups come in. So before then, with these bizarre groups, these so-called archaic mammals, there's a lot of different kinds. Some of them are plant eaters, some of them are meat eaters, some of them are omnivores, some of them are burrowers. You have lots of different sizes. You have, within really a few hundred thousand years of the KPG extinction, you have things that are over 100 kilograms. And then you even have bigger things a little bit later. So these are the first really huge mammals. I mean, not the size of elephants, but they're getting big. These are some of these things are the first mammals that are really having an all herbivorous diet, where you start to see features of the teeth and of the skeleton, you know, linked to bulk feeding herbivory. You have a lot of them experimenting with really strange diets, things that obviously are, you know, digging up roots and tubers, things that are obviously burrowing. And so a whole lot of behavioral complexity, but we really don't know where most of these groups fit on the family tree. It's likely that some of them are stem members of major living mammal groups. It's likely that other ones are basically failed experiments in mammal evolution, groups that flourish for a while in this post-apocalyptic extinction world, and then over time, you know, we're replaced by other groups. But we need to sort that out. And so that's a big thing that we're trying to do as a group. Sarah's PhD project is part of that. You know, Tom Williamson's been focusing on that a lot. We're working a lot with a couple of researchers in the U.S., Michelle Spaulding and John Weibel, on this, trying to really finally get down to this issue of where these things fit on the family tree. Because there's so many new fossils, there's so much new evidence for mammal phylogeny, genetic evidence, morphological evidence, huge data sets. So this, for us, is a major research focus over the next decade. We want to figure this out because we're talking about the recovery from one of the biggest mass extinctions of all time and the origins of basically our own group, placental mammals. These are big questions that we want to get to the bottom to.
Whiskey.
Yeah.
Which one was it? What's your favorite whiskey?
Well, now I'm going to sound like a real elitist. I'll take out my wallet here and show you. So, In Scotland, we have the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, and this is for whiskey connoisseurs, which I'm really not. I can't quite yet, you know, sniff a whiskey and say, oh, I, you know, smell essences of burnt leather. But the Whiskey Society gets whiskeys from across the distilleries of Scotland, just single casks, and they bottle the individual casks. And so you go in there, and, you know, anybody who visits Edinburgh is welcome. I'll take them there. And, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of these bottles of whiskey from different casks. And, you know, there's no brands on them or anything like that. So I love going there. But as far as the brands go, I really like Talisker. And
from the Isle of Skye.
And it's from the Isle of Skye. So that, and that's not why
how
I like it. But, you know, I would love to have Talisker support some of our fieldwork. So I'm sure the executives of Talisker are listening to PaleoCast. They better be. And so we would happily, you know, take, you know, even if you can't donate any money, there's other ways you can support. But, you know, it is a cool thing about living in Scotland. And you know, I will say that, you know, from a science side, we're building up this new group in Edinburgh. You know, vertebrate paleontology is something that hasn't been really big in Scotland for a while, but there's a lot of relatively new people, including at the National Museum of Scotland, Nick Fraser, Stig Walsh. And so we have a growing group of people in Scotland, and I think, you know, for young students out there, keep this in mind if you're looking for places to study.
Please enjoy responsibly.
And please enjoy responsibly, yeah.
Great. I think that's everything we had to ask. So thanks so much, Steve, for doing this.
Things are always fun.
Well, there you have it. I think the take-home message is that this festive season, Thanksgiving, Christmas, you're all going to be eating little theropod dinosaurs.
Yeah, enjoy your little turkey dinosaurs.
But the bird theropod link, should we be having feathers on theropods in Jurassic Park, do you think?
It seems pretty... sure that at least most of them had feathers, so they probably should be feathered, but I guess it's all entertainment and it's not all about science, apparently.
So you don't think it's too big an issue? There's a big fuss about it. You go on any kind of paleontological site on social media and there's someone having a pop at Jurassic Park. Do you think it's an issue?
I think it's an issue. I think that they should be feathered, and I think they're kind of stupid for just ignoring the last kind of 10 years of research. But also it is about entertainment, and I mean, Jurassic Park is not meant to be a science movie. It's meant to be entertaining. But the fact that they just kind of ignored it is pretty stupid of them.
Yeah, I guess it really is the kind of face of dinosaurs for a generation. Yeah. And with the success of the movie, the amount of money that it's produced, there's been a petition online started by Dwayne Nash to really send a message to the producers of the film that they should really be putting money back into paleontology. So we're going to put up a link to this petition, and we'd like to know what you think about this. Do you think that these film production studios should be putting money back into paleontological research? After all, this is where they got their inspiration from. Without the dinosaurs, would they have this film?
Yeah, I guess it's an interesting question, and we want to know what everybody else thinks. We know what the paleontologist thinks, but what does everybody else think about it? Let us know.
Yep, and also, if you've enjoyed this episode, please let us know what you think of that. And as always, if you could share us on Facebook and Twitter, we'd be much obliged.
Thanks for listening.
No, wait. What's coming next?
Next episode, we have an exclusive of a new dinosaur coming out.
Yeah.
Not going to say too much about it now, but it's a little ceratopsian guy, so we've got that coming up next. So look forward to that one. That'll be exciting.
And we'll see you then.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.